So I wanted to start tonight's talk on right livelihood by sharing another story from the Dataka Tales. And these are wonderful, old, ancient, traditional Buddhist tales designed to offer us lessons from what are considered the many lives of the Buddha to be thousands of years before, apparently, he became the Shakyamuni Buddha 2,600 years ago. You know, when according to legend, he was still practicing to be a Buddha. This is how he did it over lifetimes of practicing this. And I love the Dataka Tales, and I have to confess that I'm almost always surprised how relevant these are today, even though they were written thousands of years ago. It's really kind of interesting to me. Whenever I read them, I can always relate them to something that's going on in our world today. And so the story I want to share tonight is supposedly from a time when the Buddha came back into the world as a monkey. So sometimes he came back as human, sometimes as animal, sometimes as God. And this time he came back as a monkey. And this monkey lived peacefully in kind of a remote jungle with a large family of monkeys. And one day a woodcutter came to the forest to cut wood for his family. And when he cut one of the bigger trees, what happened is that he accidentally trapped this Buddha monkey under the tree after he cut this big tree. And when the woodcutter saw that the monkey had landed on the soft floor of the forest and was essentially, thankfully, unharmed, he thought that he would bring him as a gift to his king, right? There's always a king in the stories. So he thought he would bring this monkey as a gift. And as you might expect, the king just loved this monkey. It was really smart, and it learned really quickly, and it learned how to make everyone in the palace laugh. And so he was so loved, in fact, that he was allowed to roam all over the palace. So he roamed into the royal courts, into the kitchens, and even the guards' quarters. Everyone loved him. He just roamed everywhere. After a few years, though, out of a sense of compassion, the king began to suspect that the monkey might be lonely for his family in the forest. And so he told the woodcutter to please take him back and release him back home. And so he did. The woodcutter brought him back. And as soon as he arrived back home, this is several years later, about 100 members of his family, 100 monkeys came and they surrounded him and started asking him a million questions. And what they wanted to know was, what was it like to live in the palace? What was that like, you know? And the Buddha monkey shook his head and warned them. I said, no, you don't want to know what it was like. You really don't want to know what it was like. But they wouldn't let up. They insisted, you have to tell us. And so he said, all right. And he pointed out to one of the monkeys in the crowd. And he said, okay, you be king. You be king over there. And you hop up onto this tall rock and make it your throne. So this other monkey hopped up onto this big rock and he became king, you know. And he said, now we'll all get to work and bring you the best fruit in the kingdom. And you sit on your throne and watch us. And so this other monkey was kind of excited and he was king now, you know, and he sat up on his throne, and he was very pleased with himself, happily surveying his new kingdom. And all the other monkeys were slowly surrounding him with piles and piles and piles of fruit from the forest. And as these piles grew, this new monkey king, instead of feeling happy, he began to feel really anxious about this. And he said to the others, but I could never eat all this fruit, even in a whole year. And now there's nothing left for you all to eat. And the Buddha monkey agreed. He said, of course you can't, but that doesn't matter to a king. The point is that you eat whatever you want, but you must not give any of it away. You must always keep a large pile so that others know that you are very rich and very powerful. And since the monkeys had already gathered all the fruit in the forest, they asked the Buddha monkey what else they could do for their king. And he said, you must all come before him and praise him in every way you can imagine. And so the monkeys seemed to like this idea. So they started saying things like, well, no wonder he's king. His fur glistens like water. His fur is as thick as deep grass. No one is as wise and as dignified as our king. Sound familiar? So after a while of this, the Buddha monkey told them, okay, enough. Now it's time for you to come behind the throne and say terrible things about the king. And at first the monkeys didn't like this, and they refused to do it. They weren't going to do it. But the Buddha monkey told them, if you want to learn the ways of the people to see what it's like, you have to try it out. And so the monkeys gathered behind the rock and started whispering insults about the king. This is directly from the Jataka Tales. Have you noticed how old and confused the king seems lately? One asked. I think his fur is getting extremely thin. I think he might even be going bald in some very funny spots. I've noticed that the king eats more like a pig than a monkey. And they all howled with laughter. And finally, when the insulted monkey king couldn't just stand it any longer, he leapt off his throne and went running after all of them through the trees. But since they were all running in different directions, he couldn't catch them. And when the exhausted monkey king returned to his throne, he discovered that all his fruit was missing because the other monkeys had all taken it. And he looked at the Buddha monkey and he said, now what do I do? Now what do I do? All the fruit's gone. The Buddha monkey said, yep, it's a shame. But these things happen, even to kings. And now your guards must go find the thieves. That's what a king would do. And when the guard captures the thieves, they must be sentenced to death at once. And the monkey king cried, no, no more, no more. We don't want to know anything else about the ways of people and kings. And after hearing this, all the monkeys slowly gathered back together, and the Buddha monkey recited a little poem for them that he had written about life in the palace. And the poem is, the gold is mine, the gold is mine, so they cry, both night and day. These foolish folk who live in splendor never think about the holy way. The gold is mine, the gold is mine, they cry, both night and day. These foolish folk who live in splendor never think about the holy way. And that holy way is what the Buddha called right or wise or skillful living or livelihood, which is typically the way we obtain a certain fruit, which is our livelihood, and is the topic of tonight's talk. And as a quick review, right living or livelihood is the third limb of the sila or ethics section of the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path. And the other two in this section are right speech and right action. And here it might be helpful to remember that sila or ethics, morality, is all about how we use our bodies and respecting their very real power to create either good results or harmful results with our bodies. So this involves the power of our speech, the power of our actions, and now tonight we'll discuss the power of our livelihood, what we do for a living. Remembering, too, that all of our words and actions tend to ripple out like throwing a stone in a pond. Okay, these all create effects. And with sila, our focus, if you'll remember, is always on our intention and practice of ahimsa, no harm. No harm. This is our commitment to not bring any more harm or suffering to ourselves or others, along with the intention of practice of actually trying to create less suffering for ourselves and others, making that commitment. How can I actually help and let there be less suffering? And so when we get into the right livelihood part of our path, we're being asked to really consider, again, our intention in what we're offering the world in the form of our livelihood. Okay? So this means considering whether it's bringing any harm or suffering to ourselves or others, or if it's truly benefiting and bringing less suffering to ourselves or others. And as the great Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh tells us, to practice right livelihood, you have to find a way to earn your living without transgressing your ideals of love and compassion. The way you support yourself can be an expression of your deepest self, or it can be a source of suffering for you and others. right? Just read that last part again. The way you support yourself can be an expression of your deepest self, or it can be a source of suffering for you or others. And just as a reminder, the teachings urge us to remember that in all of these inquiries, we really need to include ourselves in these, you know? So are we harming ourselves? Or we might ask ourselves, are we giving more than we're able or maybe even responsible for? That's a way of harming ourselves, isn't it? Or if we're somehow harming ourselves with what we do. And there's a line I like to remember about this. I don't remember where it came from, but I think about it often, which is, you are not required to burn your house down to keep others warm. And I don't know where that came from, but I feel like I do that often. I burn my house down, you know, and then I harm myself and have to remember and repractice. So when we're considering right livelihood, we're being asked to really investigating how what we're contributing or who we're working for genuinely affects our hearts and our minds. This does not, of course, mean that every aspect of our job needs to feel good. Our jobs can be super difficult, right? They all are, for many reasons. So spreadsheets, for instance, are not a lot of fun, but sometimes they just need to be done, right? Just like brushing our teeth needs to be done for our own good, and I would venture for the good of others. It's good to brush your teeth. But, for instance, if you're doing something that involves being deceitful or harmful, maybe even cruel, and telling yourself something like, well, someone needs to do this. It might as well be me. Someone needs to do this. Or maybe, I'm just doing my job. Just doing my job. Right? We can think of things like the Holocaust. I'm just doing my job. You know? And if you find yourself, that's a pretty extreme example. But if you check it out in your own life. Is there something that you're doing that might be like, I don't really love that, but that's my job? You know, take a deeper look. In the teachings, the Buddha acknowledges that making money through our work is obviously necessary and beneficial. We all need financial support so we can provide food and shelter, clothing and medicine to ourselves and our families. And actually, we all need financial support to continue to offer our unique skills, don't we? We all need that so we can continue to do whatever we do that we do well. But with right livelihood, we're also being asked to think beyond our own personal needs and consider if what we're doing is done with the intention of contributing to the greater good. Okay? As Woodrow Wilson once told us, you are not here merely to make a living. You are here in order to enable the world to live more amply, with greater vision, with a finer spirit of hope and achievement. You are here to enrich the world, and you impoverish yourself if you forget that errand. I love that quote. So through our practice of right livelihood, we're being asked to deeply recognize the truth of our interdependence and that we all need one another. And that we ourselves are needed. We all need one another, and each one of us is needed. We have such a deep interconnection in this way with one another. And it's actually this profound recognition of our interconnection and interdependence that can cut through, again, the deepest source of our suffering, our deepest wounding, which is that of feeling like we are a separate self. It's our deepest wounding. So the idea is that the more we practice, the more we really begin to see, like that monkey king, if you will, that our own happiness really does depend on the happiness of others. It truly does. You know, we can't keep it all to ourselves. And we can't do it by ourselves either. You know? And the more we recognize this, the more it begins to make sense for us to want to share even more of our fruit for the benefit of all, for the greater good. And by the way, this especially includes our intention to share with those of us who, for some reason or other, aren't able to provide for themselves. Really important to remember. So maybe because of an illness or a disability, or maybe because of a lack of opportunity, or because of the lack of a job that a person could do with their particular skills, right? There's no job that meets the skill set right now, you know? All of which deprives a person of the benefits that come from contributing, you know, from dana, generosity, contributing, which can be so painful in so many ways, to not have the ability to offer that. And of course, this intention to share is the very opposite of greed. And in practice, again, it's called dana or generosity, our ability to let go, you know, of self and our clinging to self. And the good news is it really does feel good to share, to enrich the world rather than to steal from it. And it actually brings us more happiness, doesn't it, when we share? Think about whenever you shared, right? Doesn't it feel so good? And think about whenever you've held back and out of a sense of greed. How does that feel? Really, truly investigate that. You know? So when we're unwilling to share or to give, we're in essence closing our hearts and minds off to suffering and choosing to stay in a kind of delusion of separateness. So we might, for instance, notice that when we're in a place of contraction, of not being willing to share, that we're in some way coalescing or tightening around a sense of self, which is very intent on protecting and defending a self. Check it out. That tightening, that coalescing, it's all about me. I got to protect, defend, prop up. Or we might only be willing to share with those who are closest to us, those in our immediate family or in our personal circle of friends or even our country, which means we're really only willing to share with those who we feel are in some way an extension of us, if you look at it, right? That's not, I have nothing to do with that person in that other country or that other, that's not part of my little clique here, so I don't have to be even concerned about it. And this tendency to not want to share often comes from a sense of lack, from a sense of not enough to go around, or not enough for me, you know? Even a sense of I deserve it or my family deserves it, but not other people. So to support this belief, we often make up all kinds of stories about the person or people that we don't want to share with. You know, we might, for instance, put people in a category of other or label them in some kind of a derogatory way, which tends to dehumanize them, right? So for instance, we might think, that person or those people are lazy and they don't work as hard as me, or they don't deserve it in some way, or they're going to take away something that's mine. They're going to take something away that's mine. Sometimes we can even believe that these people are that we're having aversion towards are evil or wrong. We can think they're evil. We can dehumanize them. And we can harbor these beliefs about certain individuals in our lives, maybe friends or family members we judge in some way aren't deserving. We can do that as well, right? With our, maybe even siblings or something. There's this battle sometimes. And of course, these beliefs can also manifest in larger ways, much larger ways, with actual hatred and harm directed at whole groups of people. Like immigrants, for instance, or through racism, or by resenting entire countries and everyone who lives in those countries, deeming them all as other. Like, we just clump an entire country and say other. And this is, again, really how wars start, isn't it? It's so often about resources and not being willing to share the fruits of our forest, which is this planet. Not going to share my fruit. And yet, as you might recall, one of the main causes of suffering, besides hatred and delusion, is greed. Wanting more than is reasonable. So, and wanting more and more of it. Wanting what's unreasonable and wanting more and more and more of it. Where we want all the fruit in the forest, maybe, you know. In Buddhist cosmology, especially in the Tibetan tradition, which I was originally raised in, Greed is often represented in the form of pretas, or hungry ghosts. The story is that there are these beings who have been reborn into the realm of the hungry ghosts, and they now have these little tiny, tiny pinhole mouths, but they have gigantic stomachs, little pinhole mouths and gigantic stomachs. And because their mouths are so tiny and their hunger is so huge, they can never, ever be satisfied. Never satisfied. And so they suffer greatly all the while doing these really unskillful things, horrible things sometimes, trying to fill their great and totally unsatiable needs. The teacher and healer, Taya Sky, points to the way we ourselves can take on the metaphoric shape of these hungry ghosts. She says, everything has a vibration. Everything has a vibration. When you embody the energy of wanting, the vehicle of your being takes a particular shape, the shape of wanting. And in the shape of wanting, nothing can be truly received. Love cannot fit into this shape. Prosperity cannot fit into this shape. Peace cannot fit into this shape. So there's a story that I vividly remember from the teacher Sylvia Boorstein, where she talks about what we really need. She says, in the early years of my practice, a group of Burmese monks were guests for a week at a retreat at which I was a student in Southern California. And they were housed in one of the cottages at the edge of the retreat center. And one morning after breakfast, the retreat manager announced, "The monks are leaving this morning. If you want to, you can stand outside their cottage as a gesture of respect as they leave." So I stood silently with the other retreatants and watched the monks walk out single file from their cottage, each one carrying his begging bowl in a string bag. I realized that whatever they were wearing, whatever they were carrying, and whatever was in the two suitcases on top of the minibus they were traveling in constituted all their worldly goods. Watching the monks seemed to me a visual representation of the truth that not needing more, not needing other, is the end of suffering. I thought, they have everything they need. They have everything they need. And so I actually developed a practice around this story, which is every time I find myself walking around my little house, feeling somehow poor, that I think I need more, you know, more space, a better couch that the cat hasn't destroyed, you know, more stuff. I tell myself, I have everything I need. It's another sticky note. I have everything I need. And really lean into this, which usually almost always turns my greed into gratitude for everything I do have. It switches it. You know, and in fact, it makes me start wanting to get rid of things rather than accumulate more. Really, then I start looking around like, God, I've got too much stuff. You know, I have everything I need. The Buddha's teaching suggests that we all just need four essential things for living. These are the four essentials, another four. And it's food, which includes water, clothing, shelter of some sort, and medicine. These are called often the four requisites, too, as well. And I think this is still true today, although many of us might insist that we also need things like electricity or phone, cable, internet, you know. But do we really? I think, check that out, you know. And unlike monastic monks and nuns who are really provided these four requisites by the people who support them so that they can continue their teachings, the rest of us need to somehow pay for our food and water and shelter and medicine, right? Before you go home and start throwing everything out of your house, it might be helpful to know that the Buddha wasn't advocating poverty or asking us to deprive ourselves. That's good news, right? What the Buddha was urging us to do, again, was to follow the middle way, right? So in the middle, to be mindful to not accumulate more than we need and not deprive so much for ourselves that it makes us unhappy. You know, because we can do that as well. We go to the opposite extreme, and then we're unhappy. And of course, this is going to look totally different for all of us. It really is. And as always, the Buddha asks us to look inside our own hearts and minds to discover for ourselves what a balanced life might look like, simply by investigating what truly brings us happiness and what leads to more suffering, and to be honest with ourselves about that, really honest. In the Anguttara Nikaya, the Buddha explains it this way. A person knows his or her income and expenditures and leads a balanced life, neither extravagant nor miserly, so that income exceeds expenditures rather than the reverse. Just as a goldsmith or his apprentice holding up a scale knows by so much as it has dipped down, by so much it has tilted up, so a family man or woman leads a balanced life. So for instance, maybe you're making a lot of money through good means and offering services and skills that are actually helping people. So this abundance can sometimes serve to further those means, okay? Sometimes that's what happens. Or you could be using your abundance, for instance, as a philanthropist, donating your extra wealth to good causes that contribute to the betterment of society, right? That's a good thing. With right livelihood, then, the emphasis is always on how is this livelihood helping, really, truly? How is it benefiting the greater good? How is it, in what ways is it serving the greater good? Another way the Buddha asks us to consider right livelihood is to ask ourselves, is how I'm making a living compromising any of the five precepts that we're asked to follow when we're following the path of sila, ethics? And as a quick review, these five precepts are part of the right action limb of the Noble Eightfold Path, which I talked about last week. Right action means that we are mindful to not cause harm through our body, through our physical actions. So these five include abstaining from taking a life, abstaining from killing, harmful speech, sexual misconduct, which also includes sexism, and abstaining from the use of intoxicants. There's also abstaining from stealing, taking what is not given. So in the teachings, the Buddha goes on from the five precepts to talk about the five types of businesses that a follower should avoid or not engage in. Here's another list of five. These are what you should not engage in. And I think they're still relevant, again, 2,600 years later. Dealing in weapons. Dealing in human beings, which today I think can be many things, including not paying people a good minimum wage or owning private prisons that put children in cages. Right? Somebody's doing that. Somebody's making money off of that. That is dealing in human beings. Dealings in meat, dealings in intoxicants, and dealing in poison. And I think often of that last type of business, poison, when I'm remembering my father-in-law, who I loved dearly, and sadly, he was one of the many victims of Merck, if you remember that whole thing. It was a company that sold pain pills called Vioxx. They were kind of like Advil. And the company knew that it was going to give a certain number of people heart attacks. They knew it. And this is what happened to my father-in-law, my beloved 65-year-old father-in-law, who had just recently retired, was planning to spend the rest of his life with my mother-in-law and our family. And the doctors all agreed that the heart attack was due to him taking the Vioxx. So essentially, people in the company knew that their product was going to kill a certain number of people, and they intentionally lied about it. They lied because they had actually calculated that they could afford the settlement bills, and that even with the bad publicity, they could continue to rake in billions of dollars without losing their company. They knew this. And that's what happened. Last year, this was like 13 years ago, And last year, the company raked in $4 billion in profits. So they were actually violating almost every single one of the standards that the teachings lay out for us for how we should earn our living. And these include acquiring it honestly, not by trickery or deceit. Acquiring it by legal means, not illegally. Acquiring it in ways that do not involve harm or suffering for any being. And actually acquiring it peacefully without coercion or violence. This is the ways that we earn our living. And I also want to note that investigating right livelihood is actually incredibly complicated. It's so complicated. I could probably spend a week on this, actually, in large part because of the truth of our interconnection. It's really complicated, actually. It's not simple. I love this example from Thich Nhat Hanh. He says, suppose I'm a school teacher, and I believe that nurturing love and understanding in children is a beautiful occupation, an example of right livelihood. I would object if someone asked me to stop teaching and become, for example, a butcher. However, if I meditate on the interrelatedness of all things, I will see that the butcher is not solely responsible for killing animals. He kills them for all of us who buy meat, buy pieces of raw meat, cleanly wrapped and displayed at our local supermarket. The act of killing is a collective one. In forgetfulness, we may separate ourselves from the butcher, thinking his livelihood is wrong, while ours is right. However, if we didn't eat meat, the butcher wouldn't kill or would kill less. That is why right livelihood is a collective matter. The livelihood of each person affects all of us and vice versa. The butcher's children may benefit from my teaching, while my children, because they eat meat, share some responsibility for the butcher's livelihood of killing. So it's a lot to think about, and for purposes of time, I'm going to need to end there with that contemplation for you. And I'd like to offer just a brief contemplation meditation to end. So whenever you're ready, just coming into a seated posture. And just taking a nice deep breath in, deep breath out. And here again, you might place a hand on the heart, or both hands on the heart, or one hand on the heart and the belly. Just to tap into the heart. Really listen to the heart. Whenever we're contemplating anything, really, we drop out of the head and go right to the heart. The heart is very wise. So listen to your heart. Tap into the heart. And the first question is, who am I really working for? Who am I really working for? Just notice whatever comes up without any judgment, just curiosity. Be honest. What am I hoping will come of what I'm offering? What am I hoping will come of this? What ripple effect am I trying to achieve? Why am I offering what I'm offering? Why am I offering what I'm offering? Thank you. Where can I best be of service? Where can I best be of service? Truly. You might ask yourself even, what is my deepest intention? What is my deepest intention? You might even consider, is there anything I could do differently? Is there anything I need to do differently to really honor my deepest intention? Could be a way of relating, could be an action. Could be nothing at all. And if you discovered that there's something you'd like to do differently, can you set that intention in the heart? And so that maybe that can unfold. Finally, just remembering the words of Woodrow Wilson. You are not here merely to make a living. You are here in order to enable the world to live more amply, with greater vision, with a finer spirit of hope and achievement. You are here to enrich the world, and you impoverish yourself if you forget the errand.
I hope you enjoyed this talk. These talks are always offered freely so that no one is ever denied access to them. And your support, or dana, also makes a big difference. Dana is the ancient Pali word for spontaneous generosity of heart. If you feel inspired to continue to support these talks by offering dana, you can do so by visiting my website at www.mindfulvalley.com. Thank you so much.